So transforming joy, I think, is the topic of the evening, and then we'll move on to equanimity for the weekend. And they may not seem to have much to do with one another, but of course they're inextricably connected. And when I believe someone's cell phone went off during the sitting, which was good for me, because it gave me a somewhat different frame for introducing this topic, which I appreciated, so thank you. And that's basically the point. From the point of view of Buddha's teaching, in any experience that happens, we hear a sound, we see a visual image, we have an emotion, we have a sensation, there are different aspects to that experience. One is what we call the direct experience, and then you could say there is what gets added onto it through the force of habit or preconception or belief system or expectation or hope or fear. So many elements contribute to that next aspect of an experience. And usually we have the experience, we hear the sound, we see the image, whatever it is, and the reaction happens so quickly after that that we conflate the two. They really fuse in our minds. And that gives that reaction a certain sense of solidity, substantiality, permanence, inevitability, universality, like all people at all times must have this precise reaction to this very sound. But really, what is our experience? So I often use this example. I was in New York City once waiting for a friend to meet me in a cafe, and she was really, really late. So, thank you. So I took out my cell phone, which is virtually never on, and I turned it on. Watch, it's going to ring now probably because I said that, and I didn't check to see it was off. But it's virtually never on, so I turned it on, and I left it on the table, and she never called. And I kept looking at it, and she just didn't call. And finally, 45 minutes or an hour later, she walked in, and I said, "Where were you? What happened?" And she said, "I called you four times. You never picked it up." And that's when I realized my cell phone wasn't working, that it wasn't ringing. And so I spent hours, like, pressing things, trying to get it to ring. I could never get it to ring. So that night I was teaching somewhere with a colleague, and when he was speaking, someone's cell phone went off. So when it was my turn to speak, I used that as the jumping off point for just this. I said, you know, very possibly somebody heard that sound of the cell phone and they felt somewhat annoyed. Perhaps the person whose cell phone it was felt somewhat embarrassed. Whereas I heard the sound of the cell phone and I felt quite envious. And, you know, I was sitting there thinking, that person's cell phone rings. I can't get my cell phone to ring. I wish I could get my cell phone to ring. And not only that, they have a better ringtone than I had when I had a ringtone. I don't even have a ringtone anymore. How can I get their ringtone? You know, one sound and very different reactions to it. They're not actually one thing, the sound and the reaction. And one of the great blessings of mindfulness as a quality of mind is that it allows us to experience, say, the sound, feel the space, see the reaction come. It's not that we never have a reaction, but we see it for what it is. And there's a gap there, there's some sense of space. So within that, we also have a sense of freedom. Because we're not bound to that very static, rigid, monolithic view of the world. All beings at all times must have this precise reaction, because that sound is the reaction. It's not so. It doesn't mean that every reaction is off or wrong or deluded. Some are very precise and important and significant for us to act on, but we actually have a choice because we can see it for what it is. So mindfulness is not about being passive and just saying, yeah, cell phone ringing, what's the difference? You know, roof leaking, whoops, you hear the sound of the drip. I was very amused the other day because I was teaching somewhere. When I began my own meditation practice, it was in India, in this town called Bodh Gaya, which is the town that has grown up around the tree. The Buddha is the descendant of the tree, where the Buddha was said to have been sitting when he became enlightened. So I was there to begin with in 1971, January of 1971, which is when I started my practice. And in those days, I hear it's very, very different now, but Bodh Gaya was a tiny little town. Magnificent temples and stupas, but the place I was staying, the Burmese temple, was, you know, some distance outside of that central part of the town. There was nothing in between, just a dry riverbed. Now I think there are, you know, like video shops or something, but anyway, so in that town there was a landowner, wealthy landowner, who had an elephant. And the question people would always ask my teachers was, if I'm walking down that road to get to the marketplace, you know, all that distance, and I'm walking mindfully, and the elephant is coming in the other direction, am I just going to stand there and note seeing, or elephant, or am I going to get out of the way? And they would always, my teachers would always be extremely highly amused and like, you're going to get out of the way. Don't worry about it. And the other day somebody asked me a question just like that, but it was, of course, it was like a car and a, you know, more appropriate and relevant imagery for our time. And I thought, oh God, that's just like the elephant question way back when. And it's an important question. The idea of mindfulness seems to evoke this idea of passivity somehow or complacency. But really, of course, it's not meant to be that at all. And what an extraordinary thing, that moment, that space, that gap, where we see a reaction for what it is, not as totally interwoven into the experience, where we realize we have a sense of choice. We realize how conditioned all experience is. We ourselves respond differently if we've had a good night's sleep than if we haven't. So many elements and forces and factors and conditions and causes come to that moment in time. That's what makes up that moment in time. So when we talk about something like transforming joy, we're not talking clearly about only having pleasant experience. We don't seem to have found the menu that would allow us to check off, yeah, you know, in this evening sitting, I'd like peace, tranquility, serenity, calm. It's just not like that. You know, the body has its nature, the mind has its nature. We can affect conditions and in a way have input, you could say, but we cannot absolutely determine what will be our experience. And when we think we can, of course, we move into a world of fear. Now, what if I'm on the verge of this blissful experience and someone sneezes and they ruin it? Like, what if? Or as many of my students in New York City would often say, well, you know, it's fine for the Buddha sitting under a tree all those years ago in India. If only I didn't live in Manhattan, then I could really practice. If only I didn't have so much going on in my life. If only I wasn't so stressed out. If only I wasn't so unhappy. If only I wasn't so challenged. Then I could really go far. Or as one of my teachers, Sokhne Rinpoche, who I see is coming here next week, I think. Here, actually, which is quite wonderful. I saw the flyer on my way up the stairs. He's a fantastic teacher, by the way, if any of you have the opportunity to come when he's here. He's a really amazing teacher. And one of his great talents, I've always thought, as a teacher, is his ability to mimic. And the people, of course, he often mimics are his students. So he has this great routine, like, say you're sitting in your living room in Manhattan and you just go into that state, I can't really meditate because it's too noisy. So then you move your whole meditation show into the closet. And you clean out everything else and you make an altar and you have a thing to sit on and it's all beautiful, it's all lovely. So you go to meditate in the closet and then you hear the sound of the water in the pipes, you hear the plumbing, and you think, oh no, I can't meditate. It's too noisy. So you go out and you buy some of those ear things they wear in airport tarmacs, and you're sitting there in the closet, terrified of a sound. Or maybe, he may even do this next weekend, before you've sat down, you kind of smooth everything else out, everything you're sitting on, so nothing is rubbing, nothing's irritating in any way, and you light the incense, so everything smells really lovely, and you're kind of sitting there, and it's so beautiful, it's so tranquil, it's so lovely, and then you have a memory, and it's really not a good one. Just shattered. So when we talk about joy or happiness, it's not, to denigrate pleasure. I think pleasure is wonderful, and we are very, very, very lucky, by and large, that we can experience the amount of pleasure that we do. We can affect our environment. I came from, I was in Massachusetts and then New York City for a night and then Washington, D.C. for a night, and every place was like an oven. But you turn on a fan or the air conditioning, or you come to Seattle where it's perfect. This is perfect, by the way. I don't know what you think about it, but my point of view is perfect. San Francisco is too cold. So pleasure it's our great good fortune that we can experience pleasant circumstance or more pleasant circumstance. But if we are counting on that for our deepest meaning of happiness, our most profound sense of joy, clearly we're in trouble. I actually couldn't make my fan reach exactly where I needed it to be, and I didn't have an extension cord, and it's late at night, it's trouble, right? Or we have something and it changes, or a person changes, or they move away, or we find we actually cannot control things. We sit in an airport for 4 hours. All kinds of things happen so that we actually discover we live in a world of pleasure and pain and constant change, movement and flow. So without denigrating our opportunity and the gratitude I think we should genuinely feel for the pleasure that happens, we're really in trouble if that is all we can imagine as our greatest source of happiness. So one of the things I've always appreciated tremendously about meditation practice is the freedom of it. It's like the independence of it. You actually don't need equipment. You don't need a certain circumstance. Of course, we try for a certain circumstance. You don't necessarily go to meditate in your living room and, you know, make sure your cell phone is on and, you know, your TV is on and your radio is on and your computer's right in front of you and all those things. We try to kind of clear the decks and create a friendliness towards silence and a wellspring of peace, but we don't utterly need it. If you're sitting and everything is totally tranquil and peaceful and a siren goes off, you can deal with that. If something else happens, you have that memory, you can deal with that. The more completely dependent we are on conditions being a certain way, the more completely dependent we are on stagnation, rigidity, being in control, having an unchanging universe. It's like, good luck, you know? Is that really going to work out that way that often? So how wondrous to be able to enjoy pleasure and not need it as the definition of who we are and the ultimate happiness of our lives. So how is that happiness, that more ultimate happiness, which is free and available, described in the teachings? It's described in a lot of different ways. One way has to do with having a kind of ethical life. A life that's not so complicated. It's not so fraught with tension. We all know what it's like when we've not really, maybe clearly spoken the truth. And then we have to do an assessment or an evaluation. Like, how do I bolster that lie? Or, you know, who else do I need to deceive in order to protect myself from that first untruth? Or what about this? Or what about that? And, being almost like one person in a certain set of circumstances and a different person in another set of circumstances. Or that feeling when maybe you've said something about somebody that's really unkind, perhaps even true, but unkind, and they're the next person to walk in the door. And it's just that terrible feeling of like, ugh. You know, did they hear me? What if they had heard me? What kind of energy did I just put out? And, you know, it actually feels really bad. And it goes back to something, a lovely quotation from the Buddha, where he said something like, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. And as we experience the repercussions and the consequences and the ripples of having created harm in some way, we often come back to that original sense of how little love for ourselves was there. How little sense of possibility about our own lives and our own happiness was there for us to just act kind of habitually in some way. So to kind of understand that being more truthful, being integrated, so our lives are of one piece. We don't have to be afraid of who's going to walk in the door next and what we just said, something like that. To have an ethical foundation from the heart, not from a set of rules or prescriptions, is a tremendous source of happiness. Not this last time when I came into the country from overseas. This summer I went to Ireland and London. But the time before, when I came in, going through customs and immigrations, I was standing there in New York City forever online, and there were signs all over the place that said things like, these immigration officers are the face of America, and we are polite and respectful, and we represent the best values of welcome. And, you know, I just kept reading the signs because I was staying there forever. And then it was my turn, and I went up to the guy, and he yelled at me right away, like, where's your form? And I was like, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't know I needed it here. I thought I needed it later. And then I thought, huh, all those signs which I've just read for so long, like, you know, wouldn't it be better if we did integrate within ourselves and our actions the things we actually believe in and care about? And so this is a question of exploration. You know, where is my life more fragmented? Where am I not whole? Where am I not complete? And it's a question of experimentation, which we very rarely do, I've noticed. When we think of being bold or being brave or taking a risk, generally speaking, it's in the direction of recklessness. It's not usually in the direction of, like, truthfulness, kindness, simplicity, ethics. But isn't that an interesting twist if we decided, I'm going to have, like, a wild ethical adventure, you know, and really push the envelope in that direction? You know, so that's kind of the spirit, and it makes for some very great happiness, in fact. And then there's happiness or joy that's talked about that has to do with a greater sense of composure or centeredness in our minds. And here again, I'll quote Soknyi Rinpoche, who had a great line, I thought, when he said, it's not the thoughts that come up in our minds that are the problem, it's the glue. You know, something comes up and we, like, glue onto it. And either we say, oh, that's who I really am. The other 50,000 thoughts that came up don't count. You know, it's this nasty one that is who I really am. Or we say, this is going to last forever. Or we act from it. We have the thought, oh, I think I should go back to London this year. And it's like, before we know it, we're in London. And, or worse. So it is a kind of glue that happens because we're not centered. If we were centered, then we could see the thoughts come and go, make much more intelligent choices, like, I don't think I'll go back to London for the second year in a row. Maybe I'll wait. Or whatever it might be. So there's not that sense of constantly falling into and getting overcome by that cascade of continually changing thoughts and emotions. It's like we have a home base from which to observe them. So that's the consequence of what we would traditionally call concentration, where we gather our perhaps quite scattered or distracted energy, just kind of bring it together and establish that sense of, you could say, place, that becomes like a refuge for us. It's not rigidly rejecting. It's not a kind of enforced, controlled stillness that is shunning experience. It's not like that. It's really like a resting place. So yesterday I flew from San Francisco to here, and I had a few weeks ago hurt my knee a little bit, and so I was wearing a knee brace as I went through security, not thinking there was any metal in the knee brace. I thought it was just fabric of some kind, but sure enough, the alarms went off. And I was selected for special security. So they said, do you have whatever, do you have any metal implants? And I said, well, no, you know, I am wearing this knee brace, but I don't think it has any metal in it. And they went, huh. So I sat down, and at one point I made a move as though to just take off the knee brace, and the woman said, don't move. And I thought, okay. That was another kind of stillness. Because there were several times I went, oh, well, you know, no, don't move. And I was like, all right. So the repressiveness of that, the constraint of that, even the anxiety of that, like what's going to happen if I move? I don't think anything good. You know, that's a different kind of stillness. We're talking about a whole other order here of experience, which is not constraint and repression, but it is from that gathering, that repeated gathering of our attention and our energy, it is this sense of, I have a place from which vantage point I can see what's happening without being completely sucked into it all the time and just spinning around in it and consumed by it. And there's a lot of spaciousness in that and a great sense of almost kind of security in that, which is also a source of great happiness and joy. And then mindfulness is talked about as a source of great joy. Because here we have the ability in the factor, the quality of mindfulness, to be able to have a different relationship to anything that might come our way. Since mindfulness, by definition, is not about what is happening, it's about how we relate to what is happening. So we might be mindful of a beautiful, lovely, welcome feeling. We might be mindful of a very distressing, unpleasant feeling, a certain sound, a sensation, whatever it might be, a thought. The mindfulness, the nature of the mindfulness is not going to be determined by the object. So we say that mindfulness can go anywhere. And there's huge freedom in that. It's like knowing, no matter what comes up in my experience, I have a capacity to be with it in a different way. You might phrase it, you know, in all kinds of ways. I have a capacity to use it, to utilize it, to learn from it, to be with it, to be okay with it, to love myself anyway in the face of it. However you might phrase it, it's all along that those same lines, that mindfulness can go anywhere, that it's about relationship. It's something we can develop. It's not so far away. It's not so remote. It's not just for special people or other people or lucky people. We have this capacity. We can actually develop it. I was thinking of this friend of mine, Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist in New York City who has written many books on Buddhism and psychotherapy. And this last winter and early spring, he and I taught together in a number of different places. And one of those places, I heard him tell this story. He talked about, he first began his own meditation practice in 1974 at the Naropa Institute, which had its inaugural summer in 1974. It was the opening of the Institute, and it was an extraordinary summer. Ramdas was there, Joseph was there, I was there, of course Trungpa Rinpoche was there, and so many amazing people. And Mark came as a student. He was an undergraduate student at Harvard at the time. And he began meditating there, often under Joseph's guidance. And Joseph, of course, is also coming to Seattle, the happening place, I think in 2 weeks or something like that. It's like a magnet up here. So Mark was telling this story as we were teaching together. He said he has tried every year, although it hasn't worked absolutely every year, but his effort has been pretty much once a year in all these years since 1974 to try to do one retreat, one intensive retreat. usually 7 days or something like that, and often under Joseph's guidance. So Mark said for all these years he's kept a notebook. It's the same notebook, and he pulled out this notebook. And he said every retreat he does, virtually once a year, at the end of the retreat, he writes down the most important insight he had during the retreat. And he also writes down if there was a comment his teacher, usually Joseph, had made that seemed to him really impactful. Like one of those statements where you just say, ooh, that's an amazing way to look at things. So he'd write down his own most profound insight and whatever the teacher said that seemed really significant. So Mark said a few years ago, he decided to read back through the notebook. And he realized that every single year he'd basically been writing down the identical thing every year. And he said every year it was a variation on what arises in your practice is not so important. What's really important is how you relate to what arises in your practice. Like year after year after year, which I, first of all, I completely related to. I thought, I think I'm like that too. I seem to learn the same thing over and over and over again, hopefully on a deeper level. And I also know that is a difficult thing to believe because we're so content-oriented, we are so judgmental. That to be able to say, you know, if you ran into a friend tonight and they said, what did you experience in your meditation? And you said, well, I was sleepy and I was angry and I was fretful and I was restless. And I was really kind toward myself, would be like, ugh. You know, better to say I sat with brilliant white light and then I felt tingles all over my body and then, you know, this extraordinary bliss overcame me and then I levitated and, you know, that's what we want to tell our friend. Not like I was sleepy and restless and, you know, full of angst and my knee hurt, you know. But in truth, not just to solace and not comfort for the people who can't do the real thing. The truth is, the real thing is not in what arises, but in how we relate to what arises. To have much more presence and clarity and open-heartedness and kindness is something we are all capable of doing. If you're having, you know, tremendous amount of fear or physical pain, there's some things you can do to ameliorate it, but it's not like you can say, okay, I've suffered enough, it's gone. As Woody Allen would say, or did say, some variation of, the best thing you can say about the universe is it's a bad design. You know, it would be a better design if you could say, okay, it's gone. I've suffered enough. But it's not like that. And yet we don't need to feel powerless. We're not powerless in the face of any experience because we have the capacity to change our relationship to it. And so that is the essence of mindfulness, is changing our relationship. And not in a way that's kind of dull or foolish, but really because then we can understand quite clearly where things are at. And it's from that clarity we make choices. So for example, in Tibetan Buddhist teaching, they talk about anger as something we pick up when we feel weak because we think it's going to make us strong. But if we're mindful enough to look at our experience, we can investigate that. Like, what kind of strength? How sustaining is that strength? Is there a self-destructive element to that? Is that the clearest energy from which I could be making a protest or demanding a change or saying no? How much do I forget when I'm really, and I'm not talking about feeling anger, even intensely feeling anger, I'm talking about being lost in anger. How much, or defined by anger, like how much do I forget when I'm consumed in that state? You know, think right now of maybe the last time you were very angry at yourself. I don't know how long ago that might have been. And think about that for a few moments. Whatever incident or encounter provoked that. And in that state, how much do you remember about anything positive about yourself? Or a really good and kind thing you did before that stupid mistake that you're now so angry about? Unlikely, you know, there's a kind of tunnel vision in anger that tends to limit our choices. So from the point of view of mindfulness, it's not bad that the anger has come up at all, but can we really look at it to really see into its nature, its strengths, its weaknesses, its limitations, its consequences? That's our choice. And the freedom, the very freedom of that, because mindfulness can go anywhere, is a source of tremendous happiness. Because we don't need to feel so bound to the force of habit. It's like our whole life feels like our artistic medium. We are just being able to be creative. And then of course, the quality of loving kindness, or you could say loving kindness and compassion, is a source of great joy. And this is often a little mysterious to us as well, because it doesn't seem that strong to us necessarily in terms of our conditioning and what we might believe or what we've been taught. It can seem a little wimpy or fragile or pretentious, even sort of make-believe and phony. But here too, when we really look at the nature of that quality, it's quite extraordinary. Some of it comes down to, of course, loving kindness for ourselves and really being able to pay attention to what in truth helps us learn. Do we actually learn and grow from berating ourselves endlessly and criticizing ourselves endlessly and feeling depleted and overcome? Or do we learn from another place within? What's the source of resiliency, resourcefulness within us? It can't be being disconnected or feeling disconnected and alone and shut down. So what's the nature of loving kindness? It's actually connection. And the sense of intimacy with ourselves, with others, with life, just through the force of that quality. So here too, we need to step outside of conventional understanding somewhat and be able to take a look and make some experiments with our attention and our habits and our way of being. And what we discover, of course, is, you know, it's like the Dalai Lama in the quotation I use so often of his, where he says, "I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger." You think about what that would be like, to have that mind state, that mind frame, as we travel to work, as we're at work, as we travel back, as we go to the supermarket, as we do whatever. For most of us, that would be highly different. You know, so many times when we meet somebody, we encounter somebody, we can be so lost in self-preoccupation, which is not loving oneself, although it can masquerade as that, that really we're just lost in this kind of litany of, like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anyone they've ever met before? Oh no, I said something stupid. They hate me. I better get rid of them. I can't make this go away. And so on. It's like we hardly notice them. And so, of course, we feel alone, you know, because we're quite cut off. And yet, if we challenge those habits and work with loving kindness, which is really connection, our world becomes very big. And we can, at least at times, approach that state. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. So, just to close with this quotation from the Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, happiness is available, please help yourself. We have many opportunities and many challenges, certainly, but many paths that are real and pragmatic for our own much greater happiness. Should I take it off now? You turn it off. Okay. All my stories, I'm realizing, are about travel, so I must be traveling too much. I was going somewhere. It's like all blending together now. A few months ago, and it was a long trip. I guess I must have been going to San Diego or coming back from San Diego to New York, and I had a lovely upgrade from my gazillions of miles from all my previous travel, so I was being upgraded to first class, and I got to the airport early, and I was waiting by the gate, and then they made the announcement that I must have been going to San Diego because it was an immense airport. They made the announcement that, in fact, the plane was going to be leaving from a different gate and was also going to be very, very, very late. So I went to the other end of the universe, which was the other gate, and nobody told me that I had to check in again. So it's just, and I even asked somebody who I recognized from the early gate, like, why are you online? And he said, I think, so that I wouldn't threaten his upgrade, his own upgrade, he said, oh, just thought I'd do it, something like that. Oh, okay, so I sat down. And then they made the announcement that it was in fact going to be a smaller plane, and everybody had to check in again. So smaller plane means not everyone's going to get their upgrade, right? So now I'm on the back of like 1,000 people trying to get on this plane at the back of the line. So I wait. And finally I get to the front of the line and I said, what about my upgrade? And she said, nope. So it was a question of getting me on another plane, but I couldn't do that because I had to teach, and it was the whole thing. So I said, okay. So the plane is so crowded that by this time, you know, I couldn't take my luggage. I had to check even my handbag, but I pulled up my computer. And so I went and sat way in the back. And I was sitting next to a young boy and his mother. And I put my computer up above in the compartment, and I sat down, and the little boy was saying to his mother, I want to be really rich so I can travel first class whenever I want. And I said to him, I was just thinking that exact same thing. You know, and then I kind of settled in and I bonded and I thought, okay, you know, these are really nice people. You know, this is how I travel all the time anyway. This is not, you know, such a major loss. This is fine. You know, don't worry about it. And the flight attendant came up to me and said, what's your name? So I said, Sharon Salzberg. And she said, oh, we're upgrading you to first class. So I thought, ooh, that's nice, but what about all these people? You know, now I have to get up and I have to get my computer. And I felt really kind of embarrassed. So I got up sheepishly and I was getting my computer, and I could hear this buzz. All these people were saying, where's she going? Where's she going? What happened? And she got upgraded to first class, and they like all burst into applause. And the mother said to the little boy, see, it can happen really quickly. So I thought, oh, that's a good sympathetic joy story. And I had a very nice flight. It was good. But these four qualities, I think, each of them in their own way, they're subtle. They're not that easy to understand, just in a conventional, ordinary sense. And it takes certainly a lot of personal experience and a lot of exploration to try to understand the dimensions of each of them. And in that understanding, equanimity actually plays a very crucial role, because each of the other three can easily become something else without the wisdom and balance factor of the equanimity.
About equanimity and wise effort?
Equanimity and wise effort. Okay, I'll say something, and you can tell me if it's in the direction that you were interested in. Wise effort, or as I tend to call it, right effort, is the old-fashioned kind of conventional translation, which nobody really likes, but actually has different elements to it. That it's a very subtle thing, wise effort or right effort. It's not that easy to understand, and I personally believe it's like a lifelong exploration of the dimensions and the subtleties of effort. So one aspect of it is actually aspiration, and this is very rarely talked about. We more tend to talk about how you shouldn't have a goal in meditation. You certainly shouldn't have expectations or an object that's just like grasping. But we don't necessarily spend as much time trying to distinguish that from aspiration, which is very important. So I was just somewhere, and somebody said to me, why? You know, like, why did you say that? Because really, when we meditate, we shouldn't want anything from it. And I said, sure we should. You know, why else do we get up in the morning, you know, and actually sit down on a cushion or a chair? Or, you know, why do we go to retreat? Why do we bring our attention back? Why not just let it wander forever? And of course we have a goal or an object, but it's more in the sense of an aspiration. It's like a sense of possibility that change can happen. If anything, our aspirations tend to be too small. You know, and that is the problem. Like, I want, you know, 10 minutes of bliss. Or they're too specific. I want to forgive myself totally by noon. And maybe we are in a process where there's actually a great deal of self-forgiveness happening, but we can't measure it. You know, and it's not so concrete, like, okay, 11:59, you know, I've got a minute to go. It's a very different kind of process. But to have aspirations, very important. We have to believe this is worth doing, otherwise, why do it, truthfully? You know, and sometimes in the beginning it's more faith or curiosity, and then the aspiration gets more based on our own experience. So it's definitely there. But you don't want to be haunted by a goal either, because then it does become this constant stepping away from the process and evaluating, testing. You know, is that love? I don't know. It was love yesterday. Maybe this isn't really metta. Maybe it's a kind of crummy kind of love. It's so conditioned, it's not the same as unconditioned love, I don't know. I think I had it 5 minutes yesterday, it should be 10 today, it should be 15 tomorrow, it should be 18 the day, or maybe I can get to 20 the day after. And, you know, it's like we torment ourselves with all that expectation and demand, and as though we knew exactly how things should unfold, and we don't know. And so equanimity, in that sense of balance, is really a sense of spaciousness, it's patience, it's allowing things to unfold in their own time. It's also wisdom, it's knowing where to look and how to look for the fruit or the benefit of our practice, that it may not be in that exact manifestation in a formal sitting period. We may just find we're different in life, which is where it counts. It's like I often tell the story about a friend who took me out to lunch in New York City, and it was kind of a confessional lunch where he said to me, I just have to confess something. He said, I've been doing loving kindness practice every day for about 3 years, whether I'm on retreat or I'm sitting at home. And he said, my experience when I sit in formal meditation is not so totally different from what it was like 3 years ago when I began. And he said, but I'm like a completely different person. He said, I'm different with myself. I'm different with my family. I'm different ethically. I'm different in my community. And then he looked at me and he said, is that enough? And I said, yeah, I kind of think it's enough. I'd go with that. You know, and so we need a lot of patience. We need a lot of equanimity. We need a lot of wisdom and balance in order to sustain a practice through all the ups and downs and changes. And we need, you know, definitely to know where to look to see the fruit or the consequences of the effort. So.
Concentration, meditation, or samadhi, and focusing in on some object and just being present with what arises, or watching the mind stream, or maybe doing some other kind of just paying attention to where things are loosely, in a more looser way. And I've heard it spoken of, oh, go for good enough concentration and use that. But you know, sometimes I think I know what good enough concentration is, and sometimes I have, you know, actually no idea.
So the question was about the balance between practice mostly directed toward the deepening of concentration as compared to just kind of sitting with a more open awareness and being with what comes up, and that he's heard it said just go for good enough concentration and then make the switch, but it's hard to know what good enough concentration is. I mean, this is the kind of place where it's also useful to work with somebody and have more personal guidance if you can, if that's the circumstance of your life. It's very hard to say. There's no formula as to what's good enough concentration. And even traditionally, many lineages, many schools will vary on that recommendation. There are other ways of framing the question. It's not so much about concentration compared to a more open awareness, but it's more about structure. You know, like how structured a practice compared to how just kind of loose and open a practice. And that's also a very personal thing, and it can change very often in one's experience. You know, the idea, going back for a moment to the concentration, there are definite fruits, and we're, you know, from largely deepening concentration, choosing one object, whether it's the breath or a mantra or phrases of loving kindness or image or whatever it is, and just continually returning to it. Whatever else comes up, doesn't matter. You just want to let it go and come back, and let it go and come back. It's tremendously empowering. There's a lot of energy that could be available to us that normally is not, because it's just flying all over the place, and we gather it, and it becomes available to us. It's usually empowering. It is very healing in many ways, because that we form that centeredness that sense of integration. There are lots and lots of things that come from largely just developing concentration. A few issues definitely emerge. One is the fragility of it. Concentration, that's the state, you know, where we start getting annoyed at sound, at people, anything that seems to be disturbing the conditions we need to get more and more concentrated. So one has to question how free our practice actually is when, you know, it's like, damn it, you sneezed. In contrast, a practice that is centered around mindfulness will not necessarily just immediately let go of whatever comes up that's not the chosen object, but you might spend some time with it, developing a different relationship to it, the sound, the emotion, the sensation. And that's, as you know, I'm sure, considered the platform for insight. If something comes up and we're struggling mightily against it, we're not going to learn a lot. And if we're completely consumed, engulfed by it, we're not going to learn a lot. So we use mindfulness to have a way of relating to our experience so we can learn a lot about that experience, about change, about ourselves, about life. And so insight practice can be done in a very structured way or in a more open way. Structured way, an example would be being with the breath and only when something really comes up with a bang, with some intensity, moving your attention there. Maybe with a mental note if you choose to use that particular technique, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be with a mental note. But then you're with the sensation, for example, and not thinking, ooh, I've got to get back to the breath. You're with the sensation, not endlessly, but for a little while, observing it. Oh, that pain is not just one thing. In fact, as I look at it, it's many things kind of woven together. And look, they're changing, something like that. And then you come back to the breath. So it might be just 3 beats, it might be 5. It's hard to say. And you wouldn't leave the breath for the little dwippy things that come and go, but it's only when the next really large or compelling object arises that becomes predominant, and then you easily leave the breath and come back. And that's in contrast to many styles where you just kind of sit there and you're just with whatever comes up. You're aware of awareness. It's very open, it's very spacious. The thoughts that come and go are seen like clouds moving through the sky, and you know, it's just a very different approach that's essentially doing the same thing, but more about openness and less about structure and kind of form. In that way, it's really up to you. It's not an either or, for one thing. And it's, I don't think it's that helpful to consider it better and worse in some way. It's just fine. Yeah. Okay, so the first question was, are mindfulness and consciousness the same thing? And the words are used in many, many different ways, so it's very hard to say. I mean, if you go hear Sokhne Rinpoche, it may be very different the way he uses the words than the way I would use the words. So here's how I use the words. And this also is from within the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism, which is the kind of Buddhism found in Southeast Asia, Burma, Thailand, those countries. They're not exactly the same in the way those words are used there. Consciousness is used to simply mean knowing. We know sight, we know sound, we know an emotion, we know a smell. And as one of my teachers, Menindra, would say, consciousness is pure. But because we simply know. Along with consciousness in the Buddhist psychology arise a potential number of different mental qualities that affect how we know. Do we know that sound with hatred? Do we know that sound with delight? Do we know that sound with fear? So because of these other qualities, they arise along with consciousness and they affect how we know. So mindfulness is one of those qualities. And mindfulness, in that definition, in the very classical Buddhist psychology, would mean we know that we're hearing, we know that we're seeing, without grasping aversion or delusion. So it's a particular and kind of splendid way to know. We're not holding on, even if what we're knowing is very, very, very pleasant. And strangely, that allows us to enjoy it more rather than less, because we're not grabbing. If it's painful, we're not pushing away, striking out against it. And if it's neutral, we're not going to sleep out of boredom or disconnection. So it's a certain way to know. So I would use those words differently, although not everybody does. So, and then the second question was, and the last question for the night, do I recommend kind of doing one approach, since I've talked about different styles of practice, and then maybe experimenting with something else, or doing one for forever? I don't know. Well, you know, I've had a lot of different teachers, and I've explored several styles of practice. Being drawn to different teachers or different traditions has happened for me not because I've sought it. You know, I didn't think, oh, you know, I feel this terrible gap in my practice, I better find someone who can do this. Although I probably would make an exception, it wasn't that, but I'd always wanted to do intensive loving kindness practice. And so that's probably the exception, that I was more coming from me. The rest of it was more like I'd meet a teacher or read something and I'd feel intrigued or inspired or some kind of connection. I think, oh, I want to do that. And to actually try to answer your question, it's hard to say, you know, it really depends on you. Early in my practice, it wasn't that helpful for me to go from one approach to another. I was very confused to begin with, and it just added to the confusion. And I was very judgmental, for sure, and it added to the judgment, because I would sit and I would say, feel my breath for 2.5 minutes, and I think, oh, this isn't working. You know, I'm going to do that. And I do the other thing for 3 minutes, and I think, oh, that's not working either. I better go back to the breath, or I better go on to this third thing. And, you know, I was really jumping around a lot, so naturally I wasn't giving anything a chance to evolve or unfold, because as soon as it was difficult or less than thrilling, I think, oh, I'll just switch to that, or that, or that, or that. And that... that was another place where I really needed to rely on structure, where I basically, in my tremendous uncertainty and confusion about which practice to do, finally had to say to myself, just do a practice. You know, it doesn't have to be a lifetime commitment, but say do a practice for 6 months just so that you actually do something. And even as the doubts or concerns arise, it's not that you say they're not good, you just say not quite now. You know, I'm just going to really focus on that. But you may not have that experience of jumping around or being judgmental, and you might find it's actually very enriching. So, okay, thank you so much.